Hi, everyone, and welcome again to another one of my Podbean podcasts and YouTube videos on Gaudium at space22.com. I am Dr. Larry Chapp, in case you don't know, and I am super excited today. Once again, as with I interviewed Dr. Margaret McCarthy yesterday, and that was a delayed conversation because I had to cancel that initially. And same here today. It's a long time coming conversation. It is with Christopher Karstens, someone that lots and lots of people have been saying, if you are interested in liturgy, Larry Chapp, you need to interview Christopher Karstens. And my wife, who is a member of the Society for Catholic Liturgy, writes for Adoremus once in a while. She was very excited as well to hear that I will be interviewing Christopher Karstens. Just a short bio. Christopher Karstens is editor of the Adoremus Bulletin, and if you should subscribe to it if you don't, an instructor at Mundelein's Liturgical Institute, that's St. Mary of the Lake University at Mundelein in Illinois, which is near Chicago, and Bishop Robert Barron was rector of that seminary for a while. He's director of the Office for Sacred Worship in the Diocese of La Crosse, Wisconsin. He is author of the book A Devotional Journey into the Mass, How Mass Can Become a Time of Grace, Nourishment, and Devotion, co-author of Mystical Body, Mystical Voice, Encountering Christ in the Words of the Mass. He's also a voice on the Liturgy Guys podcast. He's also edited other books and written many, 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 many articles, National Catholic Register. You know, he's kind of like me, freelancing, writing all over the place. He lives in Soldiers Grove, Wisconsin, which I have to ask you about by the name of that town, with his wife and eight children. According to the interwebs, you have eight children. You haven't added any more since then.
No. The octave was enough.
All right. And he has an MA in philosophy from the one and only University of Dallas and an MA in liturgical studies from the very same Mundelein Liturgical Institute. Welcome, 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 Chris Karstens.
Larry, thanks very much for having me.
Yes, this is lately I've been focusing on all kinds of different things, but one of the central things I've been focusing on is liturgy. I've had some conversations with Adam Bartlett, with Bishop James Conley, and a few other people. So it's good to have you here. I want to start, as I said to you off screen here before we get started, I just want to start with a very generic question. And it's a question I always like to ask my guests who are experts on the church's liturgy. There's a lot of discontent in the church today on the liturgy from all kinds of sides. But then there's also, you know, a lot of people who don't seem to be discontented, seem perfectly happy with the way things are in their parish. So what would you say, Chris, is the state of, let's limit ourselves right now to the church in the United States, since mm-hmm. it's the one we know.
Sure.
What is the state of the liturgy, would you say, in the average parish in America these days?
Yeah, well, of course, it's going to depend on whom you ask, but since you're asking me, this is my answer, that I think the state of the liturgy in the United States today in your average parish is getting better. I think it's better today than it was 50 years ago, 40, 30, 10 years ago, 5 years ago. Well, we still have a lot of work to go. As long as people are involved, there's going to be problems, but I think we're going in the right direction. And by right direction, I don't mean because I happen to like it. I think Benedict's project of understanding the books according to a proper hermeneutic is bearing fruit in especially younger clergy in practicing Catholics still, that the books are taken as normative, that they're understood in light of the tradition, in light of the what we would call, I guess, the authentic mind of the council. I think they are more and more, while they're remaining accessible to our contemporaries, they are more revelatory of the mystery of God, of the Paschal mystery. So I think the music is overall better. You mentioned Adam Bartlett before. I think the architecture is better. I think presidential style is more beautiful. So while there are, as I say, there's room for improvement, I think on the whole, I see great progress in the state of the liturgy, and lots of reasons for optimism that it will keep going that way.
That's great. You know, when you mentioned, you know, things are getting better. I was just in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. I gave a lecture there the other day, like Tuesday night. Great people there, by the way. And I got a tour of St. Joseph's Cathedral, which is there in Sioux Falls, which was, it's just a stunningly beautiful church. And yet it required a $25 million renovation in order to restore it after the 1970s kind of renovation. Yeah. That had wreaked havoc on it. It took a lot of money to restore it to work. So my point is simply to go along with your overall assessment of the liturgy. Would you say too that church architecture and the restoring of churches like the one I saw in Sioux Falls, South Dakota? Do you think that's a general trend right now in the United States, where new churches are being built, they're no longer being built to look like, you know, barns or, you know, fellowship halls, that they're actually built to look like churches in the old fashioned sense?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the circles I run in, that's certainly the case. But even, you know, the Diocese of La Crosse is a great diocese, but it's like any other diocese, I think, and parishes and the faithful are not calling me up asking for a good architect to build a pole building for their church. They want things that are beautiful and have more traditional elements. And if I'm getting my cathedrals right, Larry, I think even some of those, right? So the cathedral that you went to in Sioux Falls, you know, wasn't as if nothing happened to it. Obviously, some things did in the 70s, but it's not like it was what you would have seen 100 years ago necessarily. I think if this is the right one, James McCreary has a very beautiful Adoration Chapel. I think Duncan Stroik did a beautiful baldacchino.
Baldacchino, yes, yes. Yeah.
So these architects are living and active today, right? So these aren't throwbacks to 80 years ago or 100 years ago. So I do think the trend in music and in architecture and in the arts are all more beautiful, more traditional, more heavenly.
Yeah. Do you think it's that it's more regional? In the sense that, you know, maybe some place like California might be a little more still avant-garde in their approach to church architecture and church music, whereas other places wouldn't be?
No, I don't. I mean, certainly there would be certain regions that are like that, but go to San Francisco, for example, a place I've not been to. I'm pretty centrally located here, and happily so. But St. Patrick's Seminary and Jennifer Donaldson, what she's doing in with chant.
Menlo, I think, St. Patrick's Seminary, Menlo Park out in California. Yeah, yeah. I'll be there in May, actually, for a conference. So I'm looking forward to seeing that place.
Yeah, I think you should. And the people are wonderful. Father Dennis McManus is ubiquitous. He's there. There's the staff is great. So yeah, there might be places that are like that. But
well, that's good to hear. You know, I don't go to California very often. I don't like California. I'll just say that right now. It's not one of my favorite places. So I have perhaps all kinds of weird stereotypes in my brain as to what goes on in California. But anyway, let's get back to the state of the liturgy in the Catholic Church today. I agree with you. I think that things have gotten much, much better. I mean, my readers are tired of hearing, I'm 65 years old. I'm obsessed with being old now. I'm officially an old man. I went on Medicare, so that officially makes me old. Okay. And one of the benefits that being 65 does is that it does bequeath to me a certain authority to speak out on what it was like in the 70s when the crazy season was in full force. And there's just no doubt, none whatsoever, that things are exponentially better today than they were, say, in 1975, 76, 77. Those were just times of horrific liturgical experimentation. What made them horrific was that they were often done by well-meaning people, right? These were not heretics or people intent on destroying. They really thought they were upgrading the liturgy. They really did. So that segues into then my next question, which is obviously, you know, the Novus Ordo, the Mass of Paul VI, came in and was put forward as a reform of the liturgy. And I just would, what do you think of the reform of the liturgy, as we saw in the Mass of the Paul VI? Do you think that it's essentially okay? Do you think we need a reform of that liturgy, as it is sometimes called? Do you think we should scrap the Novus Ordo and simply go back and reform the old Mass? What do you think?
Yeah, I'm for the record, I'm 53, so I was born in 1970. So I was just I'm almost old. I like to think I'm still middle aged, but anyways, so.
You're old adjacent.
Yeah, I'm getting there. I'm a Pope Benedict guy, as I know you are, and yeah. I think what he writes. I mean, so I have no firsthand. I just have anecdotes. I have no firsthand experience of things preconciliar or anything like that. I trust Pope Benedict's perspective on this, a man who's ordained at 52, who was a priest, who was at the council and was up to his elbows in some of the mess after the council, served as Pope. I think he has a good and trustworthy perspective. And I subscribe to how he describes it in his introduction to the spirit of the liturgy, that, say 100 years ago, the liturgy was like a fresco, where the main elements were there, but these were covered over with whitewash. And the liturgical movement and the council, clarified some of those things so that we could see. He'll say this too in his introduction to the spirit of the liturgy about Gardini's book, is that he allowed us to see the great substance, the content, the nature that was there. And that's what the liturgical movement and the council did. Yet it became endangered by climatic conditions. So what does he say? What's the prescription? Well, he says, of course, it's not a matter of covering it over with whitewash again. That's not the option. Rather, what's the way forward is learning to treat the liturgy with a new reverence and bringing to it a new understanding. And that is what I see as my mission in the Dos and Liturgy Office and Adoremus and other writings and things that I do, is to treat the liturgy with new reverence and a new understanding. I think that prior to the reforms, there were good things and bad. There was a sense of otherness and mystery, and it wasn't the type of thing you would encounter in everyday life. And by and large, that's a good thing because God is other. But there were some deficiencies as well, either in the books or in how they were celebrated, whether it was in a very cursory way or something like that, or it was a wall of Latinity, as what Benedict says, that it was difficult for people to encounter the mystery. So some things, there were good and bad. Well, on the post-conciliar side, right, there's good and bad things too, that became rather, mundane and anthropocentric and anthropomorphic. And some of the mystery seems to have left the building. My mission is to take and implement and understand and help others to do the same, the current missal, principally because that's the missal of the church. And if that changes, well, then I'm going to change too, and I'm going to try to implement that missal. But no, I'm very happy with the current missal, and I think it needs to be understood and treated reverently and celebrated beautifully and engaged in fruitfully.
I like that answer. I love that quote you just gave from Pope Benedict that I had never come across before. And if I had, I forgot. The wall of Latinity. That's a very, very interesting quote, because I myself am a very, very big fan of Mass in the vernacular. I'm a high church guy liturgically. In fact, I attend an Anglican ordinariate parish with trained choir, bells and smells, Mass ad orientem, communion at an altar rail while kneeling on the tongue, chant and so on, great hymns. So that's where I come from liturgically. But I've attended a few of the traditional Latin Masses, and I have nothing against them. And anybody that wants to go to one, fine. But it left me cold. It left me cold because I do prefer a liturgy in my mother tongue, and I prefer the prayers to be prayed out loud. And therefore, I do consider the Mass of Paul VI to be a legitimate improvement in that regard on the old liturgy. So that brings so you're happy with the Mass of Paul VI, with some caveats, obviously, and so on. That brings me, though. Go ahead.
Yeah, so, you know, the reform of the reform, which whether it was coined by Pope Benedict or not, so in Adoremus was established by Father Fessio, who was a friend and student of Cardinal Ratzinger and Helen Hall Hitchcock and Father Jerry Pikorsky. And their kind of one of their principles is the reform of the reform. I'm not quite a reform of the reform. Let's take the reformed book and try it before we need to. And, you know, this was sort of before Pope Benedict spoke of like the hermeneutic of reform and renewal. So that's sort of my philosophy is take the books. We don't need to reform them. We might. See, that's the problem. As I see it is before we need to decide if we need to move it a little more left or a little more right or a little bit forward, a little bit backwards. We need to change this. We need to change that. Well, where can you go to a mass where that missal is actually prayed as given and as written and according to the tradition? Well, that can be hard to find, but that's not a missal problem. To my mind, that's a celebration problem. So anyway, there's that. So I'm not quite as much reform of the reform as my Adoremus bosses are, but let's take the missal and try it. You know, just to adapt a phrase, you know, this one maybe from Chesterton about when he was converting and his friend says, listen, you Christians have had 2,000 years to try it and it's not working. And Chesterton says something like, it's not that Christianity has been tried and found wanting. Rather, it's been found difficult and left untried. Well, if we can apply that, I think, to the post-conciliar missal, it's not that it's been found, it's been tried and found wanting. It's been found difficult or unsatisfactory or not to my liking or whatever it is and left untried. Well, let's go back and try it.
I couldn't agree more. I would say that after the council, what happened was that the Mass of Paul VI, it wasn't even tried. Not because people found it difficult. I think it's because they found it useful for other purposes, for other agendas. I think the Mass of Paul VI was almost immediately pressed into service in order to promote, and this would not be in any way, shape, or form a fault of the Mass. It was used to promote certain different ecclesiastical ideologies. A Protestantizing direction, a fellowship hall direction, this kind of thing, which I think caused a lot of people to draw back from it and say, well, if that's the Novus Ordo, I want no part of it. But I think you're absolutely right, Chris. I mean, you can do a Novus Ordo Mass and do it ad orientem. You can add altar rails. You can add as much incense and chant as you want. If you want to really add all of those kinds of traditional elements with it, the Missal doesn't say, oh, you can't do that, right?
No, it doesn't say that at all. In fact, I don't know, if you subscribe to the reading and implementation of the missal according to a hermeneutic of reform and renewal, which I happen to, it would even sort of suggest some of these things. Certainly,
right.
Incense and occasional use of Latin and chant.
Isn't it true? Some priests have said this to me, that the rubrics in the Mass of Paul VI, that they almost sort of imply that the priest has his back to the people at certain points.
Yeah, at certain points. It will say at a number of occasions, the priest turning and facing the people says, the Lord be with you. So yeah, it says that in a number of places. And this is the official interpretation from the Holy See as well. But I think in the ad orientem question, one of the things that I find helpful to include that I think is overlooked sometimes is, you know, this we're talking about 10 to 15 minutes of an hour long mass is ad orientem. So the principle is sort of look at me when I'm talking to you is that the priest faces the people in the introductory rites. He faces the people when he's speaking to them in the homily and the liturgy of the word and the concluding rites. But when he's turning to face God, you know, he says, come on, everybody, follow me. We're going to ascend that mountain. We're going to go up to heights together and we're going to take that hill. And we all do this as a body. So, yeah.
I mean, the ordinary liturgy that I attend, it's solemn high mass on Sunday mornings with a choir. It normally takes about an hour and 25 minutes. It's a long liturgy. Of that hour and 25 minutes, I would say about 15 minutes involves the priest with his back to you. The rest of the time, he's facing the congregation. So, you know, I don't know about you, but I am a fan of ad orientem worship. Are you as well?
I am. But I would say this caveat. I know this is. I understand the type of conversation this is. Is that I'm a fan of it because liturgical theology and sacramental theology seems to be a fan of it, and the tradition is a fan of it, and the missal is a fan of it. I mean, if it was just something that I liked, see, this is what's gotten right. us into the problem. All these right. problems for the last 50 years. It was based on. You know, and you can have conservative tastes or liberal tastes, if you want to use those terms. Those don't matter. It's, you know, what's the mind of the church on this? And I think that the Ad Orientem during the Liturgy of the Eucharist just makes a great deal of historical, liturgical, sacramental, participatory sense to it. I think it really does make a lot of sense in those on those levels. But right. There are people that, for whatever reason, are just absolutely allergic to that or anything, you know, that might smack of being a preconciliar. And, you know, I think the liturgy doesn't need to be held hostage to those opinions, but those people need to be, they're part of God's people who need salvation too. Yeah. And so they can't be dismissed either.
That's a very interesting phenomenon, isn't it? There are bishops out there, not many, but there are bishops out there in the United States that have forbidden their priests to do Mass ad orientem. It's almost like the third rail for some clerics, you know, where you're just not allowed to touch that. With it smacks, like you said, I guess, of, in their minds, of something reactionary, something preconciliar. I don't know. To me, what's the big deal? If a priest and his parish prefer Mass to be ad orientem, why couldn't you have at least maybe one liturgy at that parish on a Sunday? That's ad orientem for the people that prefer it that way.
Yeah. But you know, I mean, imagine this 10 years ago, it wasn't on the table.
No,
it wasn't on the table, but it is now. And it's a legitimate option. And I think, you know, what you're suggesting is, you know, if a pastor decided that this was going to be helpful for the salvation of his people and help them to pray, then yeah, I think that solution is the best one. Is, you know, we might not go all ad orientem all the time, but we can have some legitimate diversity here and offer one of the masses or more in that way.
Don't you think it's instructive too that, you know, here's Pope Benedict, probably the Pope with the most developed theological and liturgical theological chops of any modern pope, who had written on the topic extensively and had therefore as pope this unique opportunity to really get in there and do something that, you know, if he was extremely opposed to the Novus Ordo and thought, oh my God, Paul VI just made a tremendous mess of this whole thing. Don't you think he would have done something about it? I mean, the fact that, we got Summorum Pontificum. He reintroduced a more liberal use of the TLM. He gave us the Anglican Ordinariate. We got a new translation of the liturgy. And yet, and some of my more traditionalist friends say he was a failure because he didn't, in a sense, get rid of the bogus Ordo and do something else. So what I guess this is my question in the midst of that commentary would be, what do you think of the overall papacy of Benedict the 16th and the liturgy? Someone said to me that, and I think this is true, that one of the things that most concerned Pope Benedict was that the liturgy not be perceived as something plastic, something ersatz, something that we could just make up as we go along. And therefore, whatever liturgical changes might come, he wanted them to develop organically, kind of from below, rather than be imposed from the top. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, well, what I think Pope Benedict gave to us was to help to get us out of sort of a myopic vision of liturgical reform or ritual reform. And that, I guess I would say that, reform is one thing and renewal is something different. Renewal is beyond simply ceremonies, rites, and texts. Or similarly, that liturgical reform is not reducible to, although it includes ritual reform. So the ritual reform would be the actual rites, the books, and things like that. But the liturgy is so much more than that. And this is what I think Pope Benedict helped us to see, and this is one of the things that he, you know, saw as a fault of the preconciliar liturgical practice. So in a liturgical celebration, there's, of course, the presence and action of the Trinity. There's a theology in this, that's going on in the sacred liturgy that is that while attached to and made manifest in the liturgical ritual is something beyond that. Well, who knows that? I mean, how many, you know, John and Mary Catholics can articulate what the theology of the sacred liturgy is? What's God the Father doing at Mass? What's God the Son doing when you get baptized? What's the Holy Spirit doing when you go to confession? Who knows that? Okay. Now, this is manifested and presented in the liturgical ritual, which is why liturgists get uptight about rites and things like that, because this is where the rubber hits the road. We want to get this right because there's an encounter with God at stake. But even beyond that, there's, well, what are you and I doing at the liturgy? Right. So Father can celebrate either the old books or the new books as humanly perfectly as possible. But, you know, if I'm not engaged or anything like that, you know, the liturgy is not going to meet its end. So I think one of the things that Pope Benedict did was to say, listen, there's more to liturgical renewal than the books. Okay. There's a larger vision. And this is what I think he supplied in his own example, in providing a context of a larger hermeneutic, and that it's not just tinkering with rites. It's about changing minds and hearts and celebrations and all of the rest. And so that is what I think his contribution is. And I think there's he could have changed things about the books, but didn't. But yeah, that's he saw some of the fruits of that it gave a perception that the liturgy is malleable and adjustable according to one's perceived tastes. And that's a deadly liturgical principle.
It sure is. And it kind of leads me then into, of course, there is the phenomenon today of, I don't know what you want to call them, radical traditionalists or just traditionalists. They get real prickly when you misname them or something or other. Just generically, there's a wide swath of people in the church today who prefer the traditional Latin Mass. And for some of them, they've kind of weaponized it against the Novus Ordo. And some of its leading voices and practitioners, the more, you know, theologically trained of them, make the claim that the Mass of Paul VI was precisely the incarnation of liturgy as something malleable, that it was a liturgy invented by a committee, that it's a kind of ersatz liturgy, that it broke and ruptured with the tradition of 1500 to 2000 years of organic liturgical development, that suddenly the church pulled the rug out from underneath of that and said, well, we're just going to invent out of whole cloth a new Mass. That, you know, the critique, I'm sure you've heard these criticisms. I'd like to hear what you have to say about that.
Well, I guess I would say the church doesn't think that. Pope Benedict didn't think that. The popes don't think that. There were imperfect things 100 years ago, and there are imperfect things about the books now. And whenever the next edition comes along, there's going to be things that are faulty about it and that could have been done differently. I don't know, maybe this is an end around to your question, but, you know, I see the front of today's liturgy wars as on the altar at St. Mary's Church at 10:30 this coming Sunday. And most of the people there don't know who Annibale Bonini was or the veracity of the apostolic traditions or things like that. They're wondering how they can keep their kids Catholic. And Father's wondering, you know, how he can celebrate the Mass in such a way that people are drawn in to encounter
God.
Yeah,
they don't know anything about the anaphora of Hippolytus or anything along those lines. Yeah.
No. And that's not to downplay those things. I mean, what you're bringing up is a serious question, a serious critique. You know, I think if you go to, it's reprinted in the Catechism in the Eucharist, this, you know, the account of the Mass in 155 by St. Justin Martyr. And from beginning to end, all of the bones are there, you know. And
Yeah.
I think generally, now I'm not a liturgical historian, and you know, trying to, in fact, it's rather frustrating to me because there's battling history, there's battling narrative. Which one's right? You know, I don't know. But I think generally, you'd say the canon is pretty much the same as it has been, and what some would say some of the soft spots, you know, the introductory rites or the concluding rites, you know, those can and have changed over the centuries, and maybe they've changed too much. Maybe the new liturgy feels like it has an artificial feel to it, that it was constructed in the basement of some, you know, building, you know, at St. Peter's Piazza or something like that.
And or that a cafeteria, organic, a cafe in Trastevere, supposedly.
Yeah. Hardly an edifying anecdote that. But you know, it's, I don't know if Father Cassian Folsom came up with this one, but maybe you've heard this one, is that, you know, think of the house you live in, you know, it was built a certain way, and well, then you make an addition here, and then you have a couple kids here, and you make another addition, then you add a laundry room, and by the time, you know, you've lived in your house for 30 years, it's, you know, no architect would design it that way from scratch, but you know, it's your house, and it's where you live, and it's where you pass on your values and your faith to your family. And that was kind of like the mass, that it was you know, it had collected different things over the centuries, but it was ours. And maybe this sort of reconstruction, or sort of a control alt delete reset back to this supposed, you know, the patristic period has always been a privileged period, but you know, to sort of, there was something going on, you know, in the 60s where, boy, they just had a real disdain for the medieval period. Just wanted to skip back all the way over those things back to, you know, when things were grand and glorious, in the little sarcasm there, if you didn't get that, you know, back in the old days. It's a difficult question.
It is a difficult question. I wrestle with it too, because I'm very Roman in a sense, in my, like, I like liturgy to be a bit Spartan. One of the things I don't like about the Anglican ordinary liturgy, and the people there know it, is that I really can't stand the fact that there's like four hymns in the Mass, all of them like 300 verses long, and we sing every single verse, because, you know, that's the Anglican tradition, and they're beautiful hymns, but I'm sitting there as, you know, very Roman, thinking, can we get on with this? And so my point is that I wrestle with it, because I do like the simple liturgy, but also I don't want to succumb to a kind of primitivism, or the genetic fallacy, or that the liturgy of 150 AD is clearly the one that we should strive for, and however we historically reconstruct it, because it does seem that that ignores, you know, another 1500 years of organic development.
Yeah. Well, I think that, I think we're appreciating that now, that they didn't appreciate, say 50 years ago, that, you know, sort of the standard narrative 50 years ago was this, you know, early vitality followed by sort of a Carolingian obscurity and a medieval sort of stagnation, until the Second Vatican Council came along and restored everything to, you know, to excellence. You know, I don't think people, theologians, historians, believe that anymore either. I think too, you know, there's a greater appreciation for the development in the Middle Ages. I think culturally, that affects, I mean, we live in a culture. There was something about, you know, this period of modernism or modernity that was kind of coming to a close about the time of the council, that, you know, just if it was old, it was bad, and it had to be new. It had to be new. And so, I mean, this affected all of us, or at least, you know, those around in the 60s and 70s, they didn't want the things that their parents and grandparents wanted. You know, if it was old, it was bad, it's got to be new. Well, those times have changed. And, you know, there is a greater appreciation for things historical, traditional, corporate, ecclesial, and the rest. And I think part of this is engendered by this encouraging us to look properly at our history, according to what John the 23rd said when he opened the council, what Pope Benedict recalled with this hermeneutic, and that we can now celebrate the liturgy today in a larger context, you know, according to its roots and its history. However, those have twisted and turned over the centuries. It's ours, yeah. And that's where it came from.
I agree. I think that the current debates over liturgy mirror broader debates in the church going on. You know, so for example, I get very tired as a theologian when I hear little catchphrases like "we're a church on the move," and you know, the church is this dynamical pilgrim people on the move, and that's all true. But what do you mean by that? Do you mean it's the Heraclitus on steroids, that there's nothing stable, that everything is constantly up for grabs? The church is just this giant forensic debating club that we just endlessly go on and on and on, blathering on about this, that, and the other thing. And it seems to me that the exact opposite is the current pastoral need, that people, I think, especially young people, are looking for stability. They're looking for a rock of truth. And therefore, I think one of the reasons why young people are drawn to the old, it's not so much, oh, we love Latin or we love this, it's that it represents to them in their mind, whether it's right or wrong, an era of the church when it was stable.
Yeah.
When it was stable.
Yeah. You know, what I've heard said about modernism is that the modern person, so this is like ending 1950-ish or something, was skeptical about everything except himself. Well, we've moved on to postmodernism, and now the postmodern person is even skeptical about himself. He doesn't know which end is up, where I've come from, who I am, where I'm going. I mean, there's no ground. There's no foundation. Well, enter in the church and enter in the liturgy. You want stability? You want tradition? You want a firm foundation? This is precisely what the church and her liturgy can be providing to people who are so lost and wondering, wandering. You know, I'm teaching a course of seminarians in their propedeutic year right now. And I just, you know, so I'm 53. These kids are 22, 23. My own kids are about that age and younger.
And it only gets worse, Chris. It only gets worse. The gap doesn't narrow, it widens.
But, you know,
so, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Relative to this, you know, I've gone to the last couple of Sikh conferences, right? So what are these 20,000, 22-year-olds thinking? What are these Sems in the propedeutic year thinking? What are my kids thinking? And to be sure, some are attracted to the preconciliar liturgy, but almost all of them are attracted to tradition. Not necessarily as it's expressed in the preconciliar liturgy, but traditional things. Yeah. And because they feel like they've been robbed. this is my story. That belongs to me. Now, that doesn't mean, as Benedict says, we need to cover the liturgy with whitewash again. They want those things in where they're living in 2024. And that seems to be the mind of if I'm reading this right, of a 22-year-old today.
Yeah, I have a friend who renovated a house. This is years ago. And as he was pulling old walls down and stuff like that, he discovered behind the sheetrock just these magnificent tile walls, and the other walls had magnificent like pine, siding, and so they were beautiful. And he said to himself, "Why in the heck did whoever owned this house in 19 whatever, you know, 72, why did they cover over these beautiful walls with this?" And so he tore everything and discovered the whole house was like. And I think that a lot of young people are like that today when they discover the beauty and the riches of not necessarily even just the traditional Latin Mass, just a Novus Ordo done really, really well. And they say, "Why did you guys ever cover this up?" You know, seems a little crazy. And I think that's what they're looking for.
Yeah. You know, in that Christmas address, this famous one from Pope Benedict, where he talks about this hermeneutic, you know, he throws in the year 1968. Okay. And about how, you know, reading the council in its implementation with the proper hermeneutic is in fact bearing fruit. And we're in a much better and more stable time now than we were during those tumultuous years of 1968. Well, as I confessed before, I'm born in 1970. I think, well, what happened in 1968 that was so crazy that they were implementing these things, you know, at this time?
Yeah.
And, you know, so I looked it up on the internet, Larry. So Vietnam War, Tet Offensive, assassination of Robert Kennedy, of MLK, a Democratic National Convention in Chicago. The year even ended with a pandemic. Okay.
Was that the swine flu, the Hong Kong flu? Which one was it? I wonder.
Wikipedia calls it the Hong Kong flu.
Hong Kong flu, yeah. Sometimes called swine flu. There was also, by the way, in 68, Humanae Vitae.
Exactly. July 25th. Yes. So, I mean, if you are, you know, if you're 18 years old or 20 years old, whatever, in 1968, you're thinking, you know, I don't want to have anything to do with what my parents have given me or my grandparents have bequeathed me, right? It's got to be something, got to be. So we're going to plaster over, you know, the wainscoting or whatever it is, you know, get rid of that stuff, because this is the fruit of our, you know, parents and grandparents' way of thinking. But yeah, I think the younger generations, you know, you can go out and buy records now. I saw a story about putting in landlines into your house, you know, with the Curly Q phone, things like
really?
That.
Really?
Yeah. There's just a much more, there's an openness culturally to traditions than there were in 1968.
I confess, I tried to, a friend of mine gave to me an old rotary phone that I tried to fix up. We took it someplace and had it restored. It still sounded, it had a terrible sound. So I eventually got rid of it, but I desperately wanted that rotary phone again with the cord. So I know what you're talking about. And you know, this was also, you know, 68, what happened? What also happened was shag carpet, and that orange and avocado were the two favorite colors of the time. Go to any kitchen that was remodeled in 1972, and I guarantee it's avocado and orange. You know, just paisley colored shirts and, you know, huge wide ties and two-tone shoes. I mean, it was insanely awful. The whole the aesthetics and the politics of the 60s and 70s were awful. But anyway, I'm way off topic now, but you've really set me down memory lane on that one. But that's true. There's a retro thing. I think, you know, people going back to vinyl records and so on. It's kind of retro, but I think that the thirsting for liturgical depth is more than just retro.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And I don't mean to imply that that's,
oh, no, you
that's
don't.
Behind it, but there's at least, the culture is open to that. Whereas it just was not, then that, 22-year-olds all over the place are looking, you know, there's an openness to their history.
Yeah. I have to throw this in there too. I was on Facebook about a year ago and somebody posted a picture of their living room from 1973, and it had orange shag carpet and sort of typical 72 furniture and like avocado colored furniture and stuff. And somebody wrote in the caption, because that room looks like it smells like cigarettes. Because that's it. Everyone smoked in their house, and you'd walk into anybody's house, it smelled like cigarettes. And there were ashtrays next to chairs. I mean, this was just a different universe, a different world. And you're right. That's the universe, and that's the world that people were rebelling against. They were rebelling against that kind of aesthetic, that kind of suburban notion of things, and the liturgy got caught up in that. It really did.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But well, anyway,
I think we're getting our bearings straight again. So,
I think we are, thankfully. But that. So then that brings me then to, I'd be remiss if we ended without discussing, I think, the importance of music. I was talking with Adam Bartlett about this and Bishop Jim Connolly, who I went to seminary with, and an old friend. And I think that music is critical in all of this. One of the things that drew me to the ordinariate liturgy, and I made fun of the hymns earlier, but the hymns are beautiful. But the main thing was the use of chant. And I lament that chant fell by the wayside. What do you think of the role of chant in liturgy? If you think it's an overall positive thing, is it being brought back? Are there more and more churches implementing chant? And beyond chant, what about just the hymnology and so forth? Are we finally moving away from the church of on eagle's wings?
Yes. Yes, we are.
President Biden's funerals. Favorite song, by the way, on Who's? Eagle's wings. President Biden, his favorite song is on eagle's wings.
Well, now, he's from a certain generation, Larry.
That's right.
So that makes sense. Yeah, they did not play On Eagles' Wings at the SEEK conference I went to last January. But yeah, chant. So whether it's a Gregorian chant or if you're talking to Adam Bartlett, it's English chant, and which they do play at SEEK conferences. And these 22-year-olds, you should see, you should just hear them join in, right? And you know, to your point before, this is a big Ratzinger point, right? If ours is a God who speaks, the language question is central. That because there's speech in God, there can be speech to God. And so the of all of the liturgical signs and symbols, the language is very important. So, right. So there's Gregorian chant in Latin. There's English chant or vernacular chant, which is what Adam is promoting. And I am too, in my own parish and in my own diocese.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's, you know, I guess a couple of thoughts here is first, I think we're getting back to the mind of the church on what should be sung. And what should be sung is the order of the Mass, you know, the sign of the cross, the greeting, you know, and things like that. And, you know, these are sort of above styles in a certain sense. You know, there's not St. Jesuits, St. Louis Jesuit settings of, you know, the Lord be with you or something like that. And I find that in my own diocese and my own parish and those that I, you know, are associated with, there's a return to singing the Mass versus singing at Mass. And this is something that goes back to Pius X from 1903 to 1914. So we're moving in that direction, sing the most important things. In terms of, you know, chanting propers or even the ordinary of the Mass. So I mean, lacrosse is, we have our own little youth event this summer. We're on one of these pilgrimage routes that's making its way to Indianapolis. So I was talking with the church musician the other day, who's a, I don't know, a 20 something, maybe he's a 30 something. And we're going to chant the English ordinary out of the missal. Okay? No problem. But yeah, singing then, you know, the propers, which for 50 years has been only hymns, right? More and more provision is made for singing these propers in beautiful settings, you know, that, you know, and why not sing something that, you know, King David wrote 3,000 years ago versus, you know, just because it's new doesn't make it's bad. I mean, it's bad, but I mean, boy, why would you gloss? You know, if the priest got up and said, you know, I'm not going to read the gospel text today. I'm going to read something based off of the gospel text. Well, that's what we do with these moments of the propers. Hymnody is a legitimate option, but rather than singing the scripture like the church has done for, you know, thousands of years, you know, we sing something else. And again, that's okay. But if that's all we're ever singing, we're, you know, right. This is to my example before, right? We need to change the missal. We need to take it this way or that way or do that. Well, no, do the missal like what's in it. Let's sing some of these propers and see what happens. You know, and then we can decide, oh, we need to do something different, but let's try what's in the book.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. And one of the things I do appreciate about the hymns, I mean, there's some at the ordinary liturgy. I mean, we do a lot of chant, and a lot of the chant was the chanting of the Mass propers, as well as chanting of various psalms and so on. But even the grand hymnology of this Anglo-Catholic tradition is just larded with scriptural language. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not St. Louis Jesuits hymnology or the monks of Weston Priory hymnology. This is a hymnology that is steeped in the language of scripture. And this has been one of my bugaboos for a long time now, that we have moved away from the scriptural foundation of what we sing at liturgy.
Yeah. Yeah. I think one of the things that we should look forward to in the years to come is, I think part of the problem that we Catholics, Roman Catholics have had is that our hymn tradition is not in the Mass. It's in the Divine Office. And so when we had the option, well, actually they've been singing hymns at Mass for centuries. This is not a post-Vatican II thing. But when we had to come up with four hymns to sing, well, where are you going to get them? You know, we don't really have a hymn tradition at Mass. And so we're creating new things and borrowing things that may or may not be orthodox or not. Well, but one of the great gifts that I think English-speaking Catholics, especially in this country, have received is the restored hymnal for the Liturgy of the Hours. Right?
Yeah.
And so these are centuries-old hymns by and large, never translated, at least never officially translated into the vernacular. And now they're all right there for us. I mean, this is a great gift of the tradition that, you know, those in 1968 couldn't have cared less about. Okay. But we want it now and it's ours. And so this is all for the good, you know, just on the line of hymnody. Maybe we'll hear some of these even at Mass, but the music direction is also going in a very positive way today.
Well, that is very, very good to hear, music to my ears. I'd like to move on though to another question, which is, and once again, the questions I ask are things that float around in my brain, things I wrestle with internally, emotionally, psychologically, and otherwise. I'm drawn to high liturgy, but I'm also a Catholic worker. All right. I run a Catholic worker farm, and I can see also a place for, I guess, for want of a better word, would be low liturgy or more informal liturgy, or liturgy that is a bit more populist in one sense. I do know that some of the most moving liturgies I've ever attended in my life were, you know, with liturgies in somebody's house with a priest with eight people, you know, and it was just very, very low key and so on. So, part of me doesn't want to make it sound as if every Mass has to be a concert. And I'm not saying you're saying that, and I'm not saying that. But that's the criticism, right? Oh, you guys want to turn the Mass into a concert. I've heard this from priests and so on. So what is your thought then of the relationship between high grand liturgy as we're talking, or it doesn't even be high grand, just liturgy in a more traditional sense that we're talking about here, and liturgies that are sort of what I would call boots on the ground liturgy in more informal settings?
Yeah, well, I think one of the main pieces to the liturgical discussion is the place of popular piety and devotions.
Right.
And so I think it's the place of popular piety, private prayer, and devotions that have more of the boots on the ground feel. It's true that, it's not the mind of the church or her documents that, you know, a 6 a.m. Mass on a Tuesday morning is not to be of the same solemnity as a 10:30 Mass on a Sunday morning at the cathedral or something. They're yeah. not supposed to be the same. There's this wonderful principle that get Adam Bartlett back on and have him tell you about progressive solemnity in music and in other parts of the ritual. That's a real thing. Okay.
I'm going to write that down.
Progressive solemnity. Yeah.
Okay.
You know, before the council, you had two choices. You had low Mass and high Mass, or red Mass and sung Mass. That was it. Well, now there's a progress in between them. See, but this, I think, is right. The two most influential books of the last 150 years both share the same title, called The Spirit of the Liturgy.
Right.
And, you know, especially this Gardini book, you know, it's the spirit. He could have written a companion volume called The Spirit of Devotions, because that's generally what he's talking about, is there's a spirit that's supposed to animate the liturgy to make it healthy. But what had happened in his time in 1918, and to a certain extent after the council, was that spirit was a spirit of devotion, prayer, and popular piety, which is not a bad spirit. It just doesn't happen to be the spirit of the liturgy. And so I think these places that are meant to satisfy more of our circumstances, our personal tastes, and it's okay to have personal tastes, just not when you go to the liturgy, or personal desires or personal needs or circumstances, because they vary so much. Those are supposed to be a part of a mature Catholic spiritual life. The problem is when we make the liturgy do those things, and it's not meant to do that. So I agree that there's a certain, not every Mass is a high Mass or a solemn Mass.
Yeah.
But beware of having the Mass do what a Catholic's devotional life should do, because it's the devotional life that is more proper to the local home, to the domestic church. So I think that continues to be a problem for us, is, you know, it's liturgy or nothing. Right.
And yes. That spurs another question in my brain, which is, do Catholics over Eucharist?
Well, that's a good, certainly, right? Our tradition, you talked about your Roman roots before. It's our Roman family tradition that we don't do that. So that we Eucharist as often as we can. But right, the Eastern churches and the Eastern rites, very often they have liturgy on Sunday, and then the divine office. Well, we get in the divine office too. Who talks about the divine office anymore, except in Dorothy Day worker houses? But
yes, we do.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I think that again, if we can go back 50 years ago, it seems like. Well, let's go back 100 years ago. It seemed like the devotional life was very vibrant. In fact, more vibrant than the liturgical life. And this is what Gardini and
right.
liturgical movement.
This is what I'm getting at here.
Okay.
Yeah. There's been a shift.
There was, yeah. And so they wanted people to not participate, not, you know, pray the little flower novena when the great treasure of the Paschal mystery and its graces is being opened before you. Well, right after the council, they sure got rid of the devotions, right?
Yeah, they sure did.
All the time. But I think, you know, especially with, you know, Pope Francis, Pope Benedict, John Paul II, they're very devotionally minded popes. And so it became cool again or legit again to have a devotional life. And I think we're achieving a balance in this relationship as well between liturgy and devotions. I think... restoring a sound devotional life would go a very long way to restoring a sound liturgical life as well.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with that. And that's kind of what I was hoping you were going to say. I don't think we over Eucharist. I believe in daily mass and all that sort of thing. But it does seem to me that there are times in the church when perhaps now is a moment to do something more in the direction of a devotional practice rather than a full-blown liturgy. And we just always opt for a liturgy instead. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that there is just a deficit of devotional practices in the church. And I tend to be critical of Pope Francis, but one of the things I do like about Pope Francis very much, in fact, is he does seem to be a man of those kinds of devotionals, very much so.
Yeah. What do you say? One Wednesday, I have a rosary in one pocket and a Stations of the Cross in the other. And No, I see this too, you know, working in the liturgy office, you know, so the bishop is going to go to St. Mary's Parish. I'm always picking on St. Mary's Parish. I don't know, right? Because there's just a lot of them, right? And when he shows up, they're going to load his mass down with all sorts of things. Oh, while you're here, could you hand out certificates and put these pins on and bless this new picture. And, you know, everything is associated with the mass. And, you know, in a certain way, that's sound thinking, right? All of the other sacraments can likewise or sort of contextualize in leading us to the mass. But no, there has to be a place. And I think it's coming back for extra liturgical devotional prayers.
Yeah. And I agree. One last thing here. I think I saw that you had an article, maybe it was in the National Catholic Register, on the communion on the tongue versus communion in the hand. And I know this is not a burning issue for a lot of people, but it is an issue for some. I prefer communion on the tongue myself, but as I, you know, and that's all we can do at the Anglican Ordinary Parish because we receive communion via intinction. So obviously you're not going to take it in the hand. And yet every other liturgy I go to, it seems like 99.9% of the people prefer to take communion in the hand. So in other words, communion in the hand seems very popular, and yet I'm not a fan of it. I think it's a bit irreverent. Am I wrong? Am I just being fastidious?
Oh, you might be. I don't know. I mean, all right. So the spirituality of that moment is to foster in us humility and docility and receptivity. Yeah. And so this is why the church asks us to assume certain postures, receive in a certain manner, say certain words like Lord, I am not worthy. On the other hand, if your mother says you can do it, then I think a part of this question of reverence that I don't hear brought up often, I might try to write about this in a future Adoremus thing is, you know, there has to be sort of a spirit of docility to what our Mother Church puts before us, right? You know, even my own mom didn't, you know, not all of her decisions for me were equally good, but I think if the church permits it, then a person should be able to receive without scruple, whether it's more or less reverent. I mean, you know, somebody pointed out, we sin more with our tongues than with our hands. I don't promote this a lot, but I've said it at least publicly in some of my talks is, you know, if I want to have the most fruitful reception of the Eucharist possible, I need to be as ready to be changed as possible. So I've often thought of all of the legitimate options. I have the ones that I like, but I'm going to choose the other ones because I don't like them, because that engenders in me the spirit of it's not about me. I must decrease so that I can, you know, grow into the image of Christ.
And I'm going to get on one of my hobby horses now. It's like, so, well, obviously when I go to my ordinary parish, I receive on the tongue and I prefer it on the tongue. But when I go to my local territorial regular parish, everybody takes communion on the hand. And in the spirit of that docility that you were referring to earlier, I receive communion in the hand. In the sense that Mother Church allows this, it's the practice of this church, and I'm not going to make a spectacle of myself. And so it does kind of, I'm going to be judgmental as heck here. I don't like it at all when I go to a typical parish and 99% of people receive that. And one person then walks up, kneels down in front of the priest, you know, expects it on the tongue while kneeling. Okay, fine. Like I said, I'm being very judgmental here. I'm not judging the state of their soul, but I have to admit, I'm looking at that and saying to myself, oh, stand up, you know, just get up. Come on. Once again, I'm probably just being a jerk, right?
Well, but it does speak to something true, right? So I go to lots of different masses and lots of different venues with a lot in lots of different situations. And it's true. And let somebody deny this, right? You kind of scope out, okay, what kind of a room am I in? And
yeah,
that's how it's unfortunate, but it kind of colors how you're supposed to. Okay, I think I'm going to receive communion this way because I'm with these people at this time. And
right
now we're getting off the rails, though.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, when in Rome, do as the Romans do, so long as Mother Church allows it and, you know, it's not sacrilegious and so on. That's my take and my approach to things as I go along. Well, you know, we've been at this a little over an hour. Is there anything else? Is there anything a topic you want to bring up, something you'd like to address that I haven't brought up yet, some deficit in my questioning that you'd like to point out?
Oh, no. I guess I would say one last thing, which is associated with a plug. And it's this, is that on Easter week, I'm going to start a new podcast with a guy named Michael Gormley, who does a podcast for Catching Foxes. And he's a podcaster for Ascension Press. And we're going to start a new podcast called Becoming God.
Oh, wow.
It's a liturgy podcast.
I think I've been on the Catching Foxes thing. I think
very possibly.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's big time.
That sounds very familiar to me. So anyway, go ahead.
So, and as the name suggests, it's we're going to talk about liturgy and sacraments and sacramental living, but not principally from, say, an historical or a reform or a rubrical or a ritual or an artistic perspective, but under the whole perspective of liturgy is supposed to make you holy. It's supposed
to becoming
turn you
God.
Into God. Exactly.
So the theme is theosis.
Yes. Yes. That's exactly what it is. Because I think, and this is, I guess, one of the things I see in the liturgical world today is, right, if you saw a news headline that said, priest gives final blessing with guitar, that's going to get hits like crazy.
I saw that. It was in Chicago.
Ah, yeah, I read it too. But if you saw a headline, God offers divine life to divinize you, no clicks, nothing. So in so many liturgy conversations, and all these things are important to talk about, I think the casualty in too much liturgy talk today is that, you know, God is trying to feed us with grace through that proverbial fire hose, but we're just not interested, or we can't open our mouths wide enough to drink it. And so we're really going to focus on, and this is what I think makes liturgy exciting, is just the grand possibilities for joy and happiness and salvation. nobody talks about that when they talk about leadership. Well, I'm going to talk about it, and Michael Gormley is going to talk about that. We're going to continue to talk about that in Adoramus and on this podcast, Becoming God, which will launch during the
when is it? Okay, when is it launching?
I think Tuesday of the octave of Easter, so that's April 2nd.
Okay, and oh boy, if you recall, please send me a link or something, because I would love to promote this on my blog. And so, because that boy, that's right up my alley. It's exactly what I try to focus on as well, on theosis, which I think is a much, but you're right, you know, write something on, you know, it's true. I'll write something for the National Catholic Register or Catholic World Report, and it's on something like that. And people are mildly interested. But then I write, here's what's wrong with fiducius supplicans. And, you know, 300 comments later, and it's gone viral and shared 800 times. And then I get emails like, why are you obsessed with Pope Francis? Well, I wrote all this other stuff that nobody paid any attention to, you know.
Oh, it's tough out there.
So hopefully that we can change this conversation. Hopefully we can.
Yeah.
So that's great.
We'll keep at it.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. I thought this was just a lot of fun. And it's also very, very enlightening. I have to talk to Adam Bartlett about this progressive solemnity idea.
Yeah.
Because I think there's something to it.
There is.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you, Larry, very much. Appreciate it.
And thanks, everyone, for listening. Okay, thank you very much.